Within Craft and Rizzo presenting The Truth.
And welcome to Dread Radio with myself, Reepso, and this, what's his name again?
I have no idea.
Ed something. Ed Crafty?
That'll work.
Okay, cool. How are you doing today, Ed?
I'm doing great. What about you? You over that cold yet?
Just about. I'm over it enough so that I can go to work. Yay. I'm so glad.
Oh, wonderful. Just enough to make yourself sick in the head, right?
Yeah, and drive me a little bit crazy, and I can feel, you know, I'm a little sore today because there's a lot of walking at my work and a lot of actually work at my work, so that's
kinda... Yeah, it always is. I'll tell you what, work, it's all right, though. The week's almost over, you know, we made the hump.
Says you, my weeks don't go Monday through Friday.
That's true. I've been there, seen that, so I'll vouch for you on that one. A lot of things going on this week, though, for other people.
Hey, did you see that fire today?
No, I didn't.
The fire in San Jose, a recycling center caught on fire today. It was a 4-alarm fire.
No, I actually did not catch that.
Yeah. Hell of a lot of smoke. The plastic recycling plant, so yeah.
Oh, man, that must have been nasty.
Yeah,
I did not
catch it. Like thick black smoke. I could see it all the way from Fremont to San Jose.
Really? I'm too busy looking up the weird news today to see the other stuff.
Get out of the house once in a while, Ed. Jeez.
Yeah, I know. Well, I was on the phone all day doing this wedding stuff and talking to all these people. I don't have time to go outside anymore. Yeah. She's got me doing all that mess. I'll be glad when it's over.
The whip cracks.
Oh, I'll tell you, I'll be glad when it's over. Let's see here. What do I got? I have a lot of weird stuff to look at. Of course, everybody knows about the ghost in the bottle stuff. I won't even deal with that. I think that's hilarious in and of itself.
But
I actually saw the video of that. I actually saw the video of the woman showing the bottles off, and it's nothing but, I don't know, blue water. You know, somebody put blue dye in two little bottles, and I cannot believe it myself when I saw it. But everybody probably knows about that by now, so I won't even go into that one. But there's, let's see what we got here, some interesting stuff. Here's one that I think everybody probably hasn't heard about yet. This has to do with technology. There's an artwork that actually sells itself online. This artist came up with a black cube. And inside the cube, he put a router box. And as part of buying this thing, he auctioned this piece of art off, as he calls it, which is an 8-inch black acrylic cube that contains a mini computer and a web connection. And it's been programmed to sell itself on eBay every 7 days. So all the buyers and sellers have to sign an 18-point contract that declares that the artistic gizmo can only be disconnected from the net when it's being transmitted between owners. So as soon as a new collector takes possession, he's obligated to plug it back into the web so it starts reselling itself. Now, is this not the greatest gimmick you ever heard of?
What is the point?
You buy it, you pay, I think it started out at something like $6,800 was the original price.
Yeah.
And it keeps going up because as soon as you buy it, you have to plug it back in and it starts reselling itself for new bidders. So the next guy that buys it at a higher price from you, and so on and so forth.
So it's like a pyramid scam.
Yeah, it keeps going up in value. No matter what you do, you make a profit, the next guy gets a bigger profit, and so on and so forth. So in the end, you know, it constantly sells itself for out eternity. And, you know, everybody makes a buck off of it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder how long that'll go on before somebody goes, screw that.
Well, I mean, you can't unplug it. That's the whole thing. You sign a legal contract that you cannot unplug it. And I would imagine the contract goes back to the artist himself. So in the end, he's going to be the only guy that wins.
Wow.
Is that not the greatest scam you ever heard of?
That's a pretty good scam.
I mean, and you can't really... I mean, it sounds legal to me as far as the,
artwork. I don't know if it's legal or not, but...
That's gonna be one for the record books to try to test that one out as far as I'm concerned. Let's see, what else have we got here? This is a good one. This is gonna freak everybody out. I've heard of a lot of cheeses out there. You know, everybody makes cheese or milk, but this one's got to take a topper. A New York chef creates breast milk cheese.
Why am I not surprised?
I've heard it all now, folks. Okay? There's a chef
That's
in Manhattan.
Worse than from under cheese.
Yeah, I'm serious. The AP Press in New York puts it out that breast milk cheese was created by a Manhattan chef. He posted his recipe on a blog for what he calls my spouse's mommy milk cheese.
Daniel, I wonder if there's a bunch of perverts out there that would actually buy that.
He posted the recipe. He posted it on his blog. He says his wife had too much and they didn't know what to do with it. The freezer was running out of space. And so he decided to be creative and came up with this recipe. I've heard it all.
I guess that's fair. If there's head cheese, there should be breast cheese.
I mean, I've actually heard it all. you talk about spirit, I definitely have heard everything at this
point. I'm all for women's rights.
Yeah, but that's a little too far. Technology-wise, you know, we're talking about food. Here's another one on technology. Boston, this is right off of Reuters. fueled by leftover chocolate and with the components made from carrots, potato starch, and flax, the world's first sustainable Formula 3 race car has a top speed of 135 miles per hour and can do from 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds.
Nice.
How about that?
Yeah.
Chocolate, carrots, potato starch, and flax.
I read about that, yeah.
Is that not incredible?
That is
How
incredible.
Far have we come? You know, we thought as kids we'd be seeing all these neat fuel systems where we would be using garbage and stuff. Now they're using chocolate and so forth. I mean, real foods. It's pretty amazing that they can make a Formula 3 race car run off of that.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. You know what? A big part of that is all this money the government's giving into exploring new energy technology.
Well, I mean, it's incredible. Now, we've talked a lot in the past about a lot of these psychics and things like that, but one thing we've talked on Science School is we've gone into Michael Persinger's God Helmet. Now, I've talked a lot about this.
I kind of like Persinger. I don't know if all his studies are true, but I kind of like him.
I really do. I've always supported his God Helmet theory, his concepts, because of that whole left brain, frontal lobe type of thing. And the one thing that bothers me is he's very scientific about it, and I think he's disproved a lot of the concepts where it comes to some of the out-of-body experiences and some of the even some of the abduction theories, like these ones where they come into people's bedrooms and all that stuff and at night when they're having sleep paralysis and things. But one of the things that really irks me is there's a guy out there who claims that he's worked with Persinger, which he may have, and I have not investigated this, but I'm just going to read.
Maybe he delivered his mail.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to read what he's doing because, you know, it's out there for anyone to read. I'll post the website in the chat room here in just a second. But this guy's name is Tom Murphy, and he claims to be a behavioral neuroscientist who's associated with Michael Persinger. And I don't know if Mike knows he's out there or not.
Yeah, really, associated is a tricky word. Yeah,
yeah, I'm gonna have to call back and verify this. But he claims that he's worked with him, and he's now selling the God Helmet online. But he's selling it in support of, what is this, Sakti spiritual technology and altered states meditation and mood enhancement. He's altered a version of it, and he's got two different designs of the God Helmet, the 8-coil Sakti and the Shiva neural stimulation, and he claims that these things are his version of the God Helmet. And he's saying that he is somehow associated and has got all this support from Michael Persinger on this as a spiritual device. And I find it hard to believe Michael, being a skeptic, is going to support all this stuff.
I'd like to get Persinger on a show. We should try that.
We're going to have to get him on to try to talk about this because he talks about mystics, religion, and spiritual experiences. And that's pretty much what the whole helmet was designed to kind of disprove with a lot of the aspects of this
thing.
Makes
me kind of nervous. A bunch of people are going to be running around with them helmets you can buy on the internet.
Yeah, I'll post the blog and so everybody. I'll post the website so everybody can read it for themselves. But I'm kind of you know weary about this. He's saying that he really is claiming that you know what he says there is his own claims, but he's throwing Michael's name around right and left on this page.
Yeah.
So I'm going to let everybody judge for themselves on that one because we put it out there several times. You know the issues with the psychics and so forth, which is the last topic that going to post out there. The last topic is again about a psychic. Now this has to do with Lisa, and everybody doesn't know Lisa is my co-author and of course is my fiance. But One of the things that Lisa stumbled across, she is a paralegal, senior paralegal. I can't go into details as to the case she's working on or anything like that.
She won't tell you the details, that's why.
Yeah, exactly. She won't tell me anything.
Good for her.
But she did mention that in one of the cases, she stumbled across something with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission when she was looking up some other stuff. And I was very interested, because she could show me this information. It has to do with SEC, which is Security Exchange Commission, charges on a nationally known psychic in a multi-million dollar securities fraud.
Good.
And this is really interesting because on March 4th of 2010, the Securities Exchange Commission charged a self-proclaimed psychic who fraudulently raised $6 million after telling investors he could predict stock market highs and lows. The SEC charges were filed in U.S. Circuit District Court for the Southern District of New York against Sean David Morton, who bills himself as America's prophet, as well as three corporate entities that Morton co-owns with his wife Melissa Morton under the umbrella of Delphi Associate Investment Group. And what this guy was doing is going around telling all his investors that he could actually predict the stock market for the next several years. The rises, falls, and everything. And was getting everyone to invest in this thing.
You know what's sad is that people probably did, and that's why he's getting...
Yeah, they did.
On charges, and you know what? Some people.
Yeah, he raised $6 million. He raised $6 million. That's why they're investing.
Yeah, I hope he gets nailed. But you know what? The people who invest in that kind of thing, you know, I have. It's one thing for a psychic to like prey on mourning people who are grieving or families who have experienced a loss. But when you have people that their main goal is just they'll buy into a psychic because of greed, they kind of deserve it.
Well, the thing that gets me, though, is this is an example of how these people work in general. You know what I'm saying? This is the kind of thing that these people do in general in most of these cases. I'm not saying there aren't legitimate psychics out there. But there aren't. But there are people who pray. You know, some people do it because they think they are, and they really want to help people, and they don't charge. And, you know, they do it because they're just as susceptible as those they try to help.
Or they have good intuition and they mistake it for being psychic.
Yeah, you know, they have good intentions.
Yeah.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions, but they have them. But there are those people who take advantage of others, and this is the scenario we see here. You know? But anyway, we've got a great guest tonight. We want to get into that.
He hasn't dozed off now. Jeez.
Yeah, everybody's dozed off with the news. But let's get into the facts and let's get down to business. We've had Donald Schmidt on in the past, and he was supposed to be here with us tonight, along with our guest tonight. But since we've talked to him, we'll get right into it. Unfortunately, he can't be with us tonight, but we've got his partner, his co-author, so we're real pleased with that. And he's going to bring us some great new information on Roswell, and he's none other than Thomas J. Carey. And welcome to the show tonight, Tom.
Hello, Ed. Nice to be with you.
Why don't you tell everybody a little about yourself rather than me try to introduce you because you've done so much out there.
All right. Well, first of all, I'd like to, you know, the things you talked about, you know, in the last few minutes, I feel like I'm really out of it because I haven't heard of one of them.
Consider yourself lucky.
I know I'm here in Huntington Valley, a little town outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, but those things haven't made our newspaper, so I'm sort of feeling out of it. Maybe after the show you'll give me you know, a source or two I can bring myself up.
Man,
to speed
Thomas,
on those.
The stories we could tell you, the stories we could tell.
Well, I of course I'm born and raised in Philadelphia, but I have two other towns, Sacramento, California, I called home for 10 years,
nice.
And Toronto, Ontario, Canada, I called home for 4 years when I was a graduate student there. So I got my bachelor's degree at Temple University in Philadelphia, master's in anthropology at Cal State Sacramento, and spent 4 years in the PhD program at in anthropology at the University of Toronto. I did hitch in the Air Force during the Vietnam times, and thought at one point of making the Air Force a career, but fortunately I woke up in time. I got interested, of course I was interested in UFOs as a kid. my older brother is 3 years older than I am. He used to read things like newspapers. When I was, you know, little kid, I'd be, you know, out playing or something, and my older brother would be inside reading the newspaper. And he used to read, you know, articles. He'd say, "Tom, listen to this." And he'd talk about how these fiery objects would outrun our latest jet aircraft. And I couldn't imagine what that could be. And he says, they called them, he says, "Listen to this, they call them flying saucers." And I said, "Flying saucer? What is that?" Well, that's what kindled my interest. A few years later, I read my first book on UFOs called The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects by Edward J. Ruppelt, who was the former director of Project Blue Book, the Air Force's investigative arm for UFOs. It was really a public, what would you call it, sort PR of a sham organization, yeah. A PR group. That's public relations.
Right.
The real stuff was going somewhere else. So I was interested in UFOs for a while, and along around 1980, out comes this book called The Roswell Incident by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. And when I read that, boy, I was hooked. Because what that book was telling me was that there was a nuts and bolts craft, or wreckage of saying, hidden somewhere in the government with little bodies and things like that. And boy, that really had an impact on me, because we're not talking lights in the sky and oil stains in the farmer's field, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This was real artifacts type stuff. Well, that was 1980, and that was the only book on crash saucers for a while. And lo and behold, there's this two fellas that out of Chicago, well, the group was out of Chicago, the Center for UFO Studies, QFOS as they call it, they were reinvestigating or reopening the investigation of the famous, well, it wasn't famous then, the Roswell incident. And that would be Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt had teamed up to take a look at this case, hopefully to put it to rest, as Don told me, with one trip to Roswell. Well, they get down to Roswell, and they start interviewing some witnesses, and they had to change their opinion, because they thought going down that it was just a bunch of bunk, and they'd be able to dispose of it rather quickly. Well, after interviewing Walter Hout and the rancher's son, Bill Brazel, and a few others, they did an about-face, and here we are, over 20 years later, still investigating this case. Now, I point to the book that Don and Kevin wrote in 1991 called UFO Crash at Roswell as the book that really reopened the, made the case a household name around the world. It was their 1991 book. Really, really got things going. They followed it up with a 1994 book, Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, and then the absolute pinnacle of interest in the case occurred in 1997, which was the 50th anniversary, if you recall, of the case. I mean, for the July 4th weekend that year, Roswell was it. It was covered by all the networks. They had cameras down there, panel discussions. It was just a big hoopla, is the only word I can think of, but it made Roswell a household name around the world. By that time, I had contacted Randall and Schmidt actually in 1991, a few years before that, because one of the aspects of the let's call it the legend of Roswell was that it was the craft and the bodies were discovered by a group of archaeologists from the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia. Now, here I was, interested in Roswell. I had degrees in anthropology, and the University of Pennsylvania was just a stone's throw from my house. So I called up Randall. I said, what have you done on the archaeologists? Have you found them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? He says, well, we tried to locate them, but we couldn't get anywhere with just the, you know, that thread or that lead just sort of dried up. I said, well, let me have a crack at it. Let me go down to the university here in Pennsylvania, see what I can find out. So to make a long story short, after spending a number of weekends at the university's Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology, I was able to identify some of the archaeologists involved or not involved. And that's how I became sort of a hands-on investigator of this case. It was the archaeology connection. And so in the mid-90s, Randall and Schmidt sort of separated and went their separate ways. And by that time, I was a member of the board of directors and a special investigator for QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. So we would have quarterly meetings, and at one of the meetings in 1998, Don Schmidt came down from Wisconsin to give a talk on the latest on the Roswell investigation, of which there basically wasn't any going on at that time outside of myself and him. And after his talk, he said, I'm going to Roswell in May. This would be May of 98. Does anybody want to come with me? And I said, yes, I do. Another fellow was sort of equivocating. He wasn't sure. He said it was a 50-50 possibility he could go, which meant that he wasn't going. So Don and I took our first trip together to Roswell in May of 1998. Now here it is, we're coming up on May of 2010, so that's what, 12 years ago? We're still a team, functioning team, after 12 years.
Nice.
And we moved
Don,
the case.
Scary thought.
Well, he lives in Wisconsin, I live in Pennsylvania, so it works out good. So that's how Don and I hooked up. The reason was we wanted to continue a proactive investigation of the case. We weren't satisfied with where it was in the mid-90s. He had written two books with Kevin Randall, and there were other books out there. The 1997 year saw the most books ever written on the case. Everybody was writing a book about Roswell. And most of them were ones that you would not admit to owning. But that was the situation. But we wanted to continue to investigate the case because the witnesses were getting old. And as we speak now, I would say that of the first-hand witnesses out there, less than 10% are still alive. It's probably closer to 5%. And they're now in their 80s. Suffering the maladies of old age. So
well, I think that's part of that's part of the whole government's game plan, if you ask me.
It absolutely is.
That's why they waited to declassify a lot of the information and put out their report. Was they wanted half the people to die off, so they couldn't.
They're all dead. Yeah, absolutely. And we had one witness tell us he's dead now. But on his deathbed, we said, well, what's the plan here? He says, the plan is to run out the clock. They're running out the clock, to use a football and basketball term, until everybody dies. And he died soon thereafter. And that's what their game plan is. They will never, the government, people ask us, well, when do you think they'll come clean on that? They will never come clean on Roswell, never, because it would certainly be an admission of lying to us all these years, but the thing that they really want to cover up, besides the technology, is the fact that they used extreme measures to silence people, Roswell civilians, and they don't ever want to come clean on that. And that's one of the things our investigation with Don has uncovered, is the extreme measures they went to silence the civilian witnesses in and around Roswell. And they will never come clean on that. So, and for that reason, they may never come clean on the UFOs in general. Because
see, that's the one issue I do have to say, Tom, I've spoken with Jesse Marcel Jr., and that's the one thing he did tell me, is they were never threatened, though. You know, he said
his father was a straight arrow military guy, so they just all they had to tell him was, don't ever talk about this again. And so they didn't. Until very late in life, when Jesse Sr. became a known witness, and even then, he didn't tell his son everything.
That's true.
And he gave the public half a loaf. You know, you have the full loaf, but he gave us half a loaf because he claimed he didn't know about the bodies. And we know that's not true because we have that from people who knew Jesse in the military, and he did know about the bodies. But he never told his son, we believe, to protect him so his son wouldn't suffer any consequences of that having that knowledge.
Now, when you mentioned this person who's passed away, I'm assuming that, there's many that have passed away that have given you information after they passed away on their deathbed, but I'm assuming one of them is the individual you mentioned earlier, and I'll ask you to give a little background on it, is First Lieutenant Walter Haught.
Yes, Walter Haught is passed away in December of 2005. It's about 4 years ago. I've known Walter for over 10 years, and Don knew him for over 15. And I would say that anyone outside of the Walter Haught family, we knew him the best. He was the public information officer at the Roswell base in 47. And he was a good friend, buddies, if you will, with the base commander, William Blanchard. Blanchard was a colonel. Haught was a first lieutenant. And it was Haught that was called into the commander's office and, you know, told to issue a press release announcing the capture, as they called it, of a flying saucer. That's the term that they used, on a ranch near Roswell. And Haught, you know, says, do you really want me to put this out there? And the base commander says, yes, of course. So they put out the story that went around the world in a flash, that these strange things that had been being seen in the sky for about 2 weeks. Remember now, the modern age of UFOs was only 2 weeks old when the Roswell incident happened. Kenneth Arnold.
Kenneth Arnold had only made his
sighting in 2.5 weeks prior, on June 24th, near Mount Rainier in Washington, where he saw 9 silvery disks, and he said they resembled a plate, a saucer, being skipped across the water, which coined the term flying saucer, and that was only 2 weeks prior to the Roswell incident. So the headline goes out, and they never expected the reaction. Everybody all around the world wanted to know more about this, and Haught was ordered to go home, and the base commander claimed he went on leave. We know he didn't, but that's what he told the press. Everybody that knew anything was put on ice, so to speak, so the press really couldn't get any more information. And then the story was killed the following day by a press conference in Fort Worth by Blanchard's immediate superior officer, General Roger Ramey, who, you know, put out the famous weather balloon story, held a press conference in his office with a ripped up radar kite on his floor and a rubber balloon that he kneeled beside.
The infamous weather balloons, yes.
Yes, the famous weather balloon story, and that killed the Roswell incident for 30 years. Hastily put together press conference with that phony balloon and phony baloney weather target, radar weather target. So Haught was off the hook, Blanchard was off the hook, everybody was off the hook, and everybody went home happy. Except, you know, a few people in the press were skeptical, but they had no information to go by. So that was it for 30 years. And when the case picked up again, Walter Haught was one of the first witnesses that the people gravitated to. He still lived in Roswell. He was an insurance man. He had an art gallery. He had I don't know what else he did there, but he was also one of the three founders of the UFO Museum, which is still in operation on Main Street in Roswell. Now, when we first met Walter, it was clear to us that here was a honorable person. He was the kind of guy that if you had a club or an organization, you wanted him to be your president. That's the kind of guy he was. And the thing about Walter Hout, though, that I noticed, that always made me wonder, was just his manner and the way he spoke and the way he carried himself. I said, here's a guy carrying a secret. He only would give out the press release story. And we say, but Walter, you were at the center of this. You were the base commander's best trusted officer. You don't know any more than the press release? And he says, nope, that's all I know. I said, well, you know, didn't you even ask? He said, well, I can't remember. So everything we asked of a more specific nature that we thought he should have known about, he would say, I can't remember. And all I remember is the press release. Well, that never sat well with me or Don. We didn't get belligerent or anything with Hout. We just continued to go down there and visit, and year after year, and we became very good friends. And in 2002, we got the idea. Well, this guy, he's obviously, at least in our minds, he's promised Butch Blanchard, the commanding officer, that he would never speak about what really happened at Roswell, other than the press release, which he couldn't get away from because everybody knew he was the one who took it around to the media. So we got the idea of having him do a sealed statement. And over the years, from our investigation, we came to believe certain things about Walter Hout.
All right, well, hang on just a second, Tom. Let me stop you there because it's break time. And I'll tell you what, let's come back on that sealed statement because that was where I wanted to go next. I think that's very important. So let's save that for when we come back on break so everybody can keep up. That's a real important part, and that's where I wanted to get next. So let's save that until we come back from break, okay?
Sure.
Okay. So, Reap, why don't you take us out on that break?
We'll be back in 4 minutes, 11.7 seconds. You're listening to Dread Radio.
Here again, oh
And welcome back live here to Dread Radio. I'm Ed Kraft, along with my cohort in crime, Reepso.
That's right. Welcome back.
And our guest today, Thomas J. Carey, co-author of Witness to Roswell. Actually, he's got a new update. Both of them have a new updated version with some real great new evidence that they both put together. And I'll tell you what, if you haven't checked it out, check it out. I really encourage everyone to, because I have looked at the original version versus the updated version, and there's some real shocking new information on the topic. That's why we got him on. We've had Don on. Don was supposed to be with us, but I'll tell you what, I think Tom's doing a great job of filling us in on the new info. Kudos to you, Tom.
Well,
I really have to admit, you're bringing
out
some great stuff.
And thank you. Yeah. And thank you. Our first book, Witness to Roswell, came out in 2007. According to our publisher, it was the number one selling UFO book in the world for two years, 2007 and 2008. So they were only too happy to do a revised, updated, and expanded version, also called Witness to Roswell, published in 2009. And that's
you're not
up
modest,
at the top.
Are you?
just trying to get the word out. Just trying to get the word out, and it's doing very well too. We get emails from all over the world. From people who have read it, doctors, scientists, even skeptics, and the skeptics say they will have to rethink their position after reading our book. There's so much information in it that they find it very compelling.
Now, right before the break, we were talking about Walter Hawk, and you were about to talk about his affidavit.
Yes. Over the years, Don and I, in interviewing witnesses, we came to certain conclusions about Walter Hout, that he really had to know more about the incident than he was publicly stating. So we put together an affidavit, or a list of things we believe to be true about Walter Hout. And we typed it up in the first person, like, I did this, and I did that, and I knew this, and I knew that. And we presented it to him and his family, his daughter, his daughter Julie Schuster, who runs the UFO Museum now down in Roswell. And we said, Walter, would you be agreeable to doing a sealed statement? A signed and sealed statement to be opened after your passing. Now he was he was in his early 80s at that point. He was still, you know, sharp, but his physical, you know, physical properties were declining. But that doesn't mean his brain wasn't functioning A number one, which it was. So he agreed. He said, well, let me take a look at it. And so we didn't put any pressure on him. We weren't looking over his shoulder. We, you know, when our Don went back to Wisconsin and I went back to Pennsylvania, and he went over it with his family and with the lawyer present, and he came up with the sealed statement that we opened after his death, and which appeared, we transcribed it in the first edition of our book, but we have the actual copy of the sealed statement in the expanded version of our book. And so it was a real eye-opener, and everything that we had put in this, the list of particulars that we presented to Walter, every one of those was in the sealed statement. So we were dead on in what we had concluded about him. So it turns out that he did know a lot more, and he was present. For instance, the day after they found the craft and the bodies, they had an early 8 a.m. meeting at the base. General Roger Ramey flew in from Fort Worth. He was the commanding officer of the 8th Air Force, you know, the mighty 8th from World War II fame, and to which the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell was attached. He flew in with his adjutant, all of Colonel Blanchard's regular staffers were there, and Walter Hout was present. So he tells what went on at that meeting, how they passed around a piece of the wreckage that nobody just, they just were stupefied by this piece of wreckage. And they set in motion a plan to deal with this regarding the public. Now, one of the suggestions was, well, why don't we just go tell the truth? You know, you never can get in trouble with telling the truth. Well, the thing was, we learned from another witness that who was also present, that what they found was technology beyond our present technology in 1947. And the thing was that they didn't understand it, but they didn't know what their, and I put the quotes around there, intentions might be. So the military, whenever you don't understand something, they cover it up, because they always want to present a front that they know everything, they're in control, you know what I mean?
Yeah, even if they have to use disinformation, right?
Yeah, they're in charge. I mean, there's nothing that's beyond them. So they don't want to go out there and admit, hey, we're not in control of our skies. We don't know what this is. This is technology beyond us. We do not want to let on that that's what's going on. Also, the famous War of the Worlds radio broadcast from 1938 was only 9 years prior to that, where the entire East Coast rioted.
So there was still a lot of paranoia going on, right?
What's that?
Still a lot of paranoia going on over that broadcast. So,
oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Even though they announced on the radio that it was a theatrical portrayal of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, they announced that at every commercial.
Yeah.
They still rioted and. What was it? Grover's Mill, New Jersey, is where the thing allegedly was supposed to have landed. But that was still, you know, they panicked. They panicked, and they didn't want that to happen. They weren't sure that it would, but they weren't sure that it wouldn't. So for those reasons, and they also didn't want the Russians to know anything about this, because in 1947, the Cold War, the Iron Curtain had just descended. And the Cold War was just starting up.
Yeah.
The Berlin airlift was less than a year away. And so the decision was made to cover. So they put out, and the best way you cover up something is you put out the truth first, and then pull out the rug from under everybody who,
right?
Yeah. You make everybody feel silly for believing the first story, and that's what they did. And that held for 30 years. But Walter Hout was in on that meeting, and that's how we found out about how this event was to be handled. Because there was always a debate whether it was a local faux pas on the part of the Colonel Blanchard, whether he was a loose cannon and went out on his own with his story. And I can't imagine anyone in his position going out without checking with his commanding officer first whether he should do it or not. But that was one of the theories that was that this base commander, William Blanchard, was just a loose cannon, and he went out there on his own and did this story. Well, that's not what happened. This was all orchestrated from Washington, and we have that from someone who was inside on the meeting. It also turns out that Walter Hout saw the bodies. Before he was sent home by Blanchard, Blanchard took him over to the hangar. It was P3 back in 47, but it's now Building 84 on the base. It's still standing, and I've been in it. So is Don.
Okay, good. Someone had a question about that earlier and was asking. And I thought they'd plowed that building down.
No. There a lot of buildings have been plowed under.
Is that the hospital they plowed down?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the hospital is gone totally. The last structure from the hospital was plowed under about 1995. Fortunately, I got some pictures of it. Had I known it was going to be plowed under when I was there, I would have gone inside, just to take pictures if nothing else, right? So, but the big hangar, as they called it, where all the wreckage and the bodies were taken, is still standing. It's still an operating hangar. I mean, business is still conducted in there. I did take a picture of a little side room where legend has it that's where the bodies were kept on ice prior to being shipped out. So I take pictures of everything. I always go down there with my camera, and I take pictures of everything, not knowing what's going to be there the next time I visit. So. And Hout was taken over to the hangar by William Blanchard. Now, this hangar was under security. It was guarded by security personnel with armed machine guns. And, if you trespassed there, you were shot. And
Use of deadly force authorized, right?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And we know of someone who was shot.
Yeah, there's still Air Force bases are still like that these days. So,
yes, and we know that in another instance, officers wanted to know. They saw this ring around the hangar, and they'd say ask their commanding officer. This would be like of a bomb squadron. Hey, what's going on at the hangar? And all they were told was, don't go near the hangar. You run the risk of getting shot.
Yeah, you know what? And I can vouch for that because I used to do landscaping, actually, at Beale Air Force Base. And we had a guy one day with a weed whacker that walked over the flight line. And that guy got slammed to the ground with M16s to his head. And he's saying, I'm an American citizen. And they said, you know what? You're not shit until we tell you you are. So, you know,
right.
They do not screw around on that, you know?
Right.
Yep.
Now, you have to understand that The Roswell base at that time in 1947 was our country's first SAC base, Strategic Air Command.
Right.
You remember the old Jimmy Stewart movie, Strategic Air Command, where he gives up a baseball career to be a SAC pilot. Well, Roswell was our first SAC base, and security and restriction and use of deadly force authorized was a way of life there. And there were signs all over, not to talk. When you leave the base, what you see here, what you hear here, you leave here. Something like that. So, In goes Blanchard and his trusted PIO Walter Hout, and Hout told us, or at least in this statement, that he could see the gurneys where that had these little creatures on them. He would say that they were child-sized, but the striking feature was large, having a large head. Small frame, large head. He didn't get close enough to see details, but he knew that there was something strange going on in there. He saw wreckage in there, and he saw a lot of medical personnel around the gurneys looking at these small creatures with large heads. So he did see the bodies. And,
now, that's an interesting point, too, that, you know, I've heard so many descriptions. You've got the mortician story. You've got... now, the one I really that's really compelling, and I have problems with the mortician story, and we won't bring up any names here, but it's Benjamin's story that really, I believe it's Eli Benjamin's story that really is compelling.
Yes.
That's what I really believe.
Yes, we have Glenn Dennis. His story was of, he actually didn't see anything himself other than a few pieces of wreckage in the back of some ambulance carriers. He saw wreckage in the rear of those carriers, but he didn't see any bodies himself. He was told about the bodies by a nurse friend of his who had seen him in the hospital after he had delivered an injured airman. She had come out of an examination room where apparently a preliminary autopsy was being attempted. She had a towel over her face, coughing and wheezing, and she told Glenn Dennis, the mortician, to get out of there, that he didn't belong there, that he would get in trouble. Of course, Dennis didn't know what was going on, other than having seen a lot of medical personnel he didn't recognize. And so he was threatened, and he was told to leave, and he was followed all the way back to the Ballard Funeral Home just to make sure that he got there. And the next day, he met his nurse friend at the officers' club, where she took out a prescription pad, and on the back of it she drew pictures of what the aliens looked like. She said, this is what was going on. They were trying to do an autopsy of these small creatures that were recovered from a crash site north of town. And the smell was so bad that everybody was getting sick, and they finally had to stop the autopsy because the smell was so bad, and that's why she had the towel over her face. And that's when she ran into Dennis in the hospital and told him to get out of there. And Glenn Dennis would never see her again. The story was that she was transferred out to England to another base where she was killed in a training air accident, in an aircraft that crashed. And so the investigators, we tried to find any reference to this nurse. He gave us the name Naomi Maria Self, and we spent about 2 years on that. Never could come up with one scintilla of evidence that there was ever an Army nurse by that name. And he says, oh, well, I guess I should tell you, I gave you a phony name. And, you know, can you imagine spending 2 years of your life looking for this, and he'd given us a phony name? Well, in a court of law, that would impeach him as a witness of any kind other than
exactly
one not to be believed. So... But the thing is, the rest of his story, outside of the nurse's name, the rest of his story has been corroborated by others. And namely, there were bodies at the hospital. Others had seen them. He did talk about receiving calls from the Air Force wanting to know about child-sized caskets, hermetically sealed child-sized caskets. We have witnesses who remember Glenn Dennis talking about that at the time of the incident.
But here's my catch. Has any witness come forward and said they saw Glenn Dennis there on the reverse side of that coin? There are other witnesses that can put Benjamin there and other witnesses there, but we don't have one that has put Glenn Dennis there. He's been kind of ousted with his own statements, but... I'm not saying that he didn't tell the truth, but what I'm saying, we have to push him aside as credible because of his own statement. But we have others, like like Eli Benjamin, who have
come forward. We don't need Glenn Dennis' story. We don't need it because we have others who saw the aliens at the hospital. His story is an interesting thing. We spent a lot of time on it, and because of his giving us a phony name, lying, if you wish, he would be you can't use him as a witness.
But I don't want to say he lied. I just want to say he was deceptive in his. Well, I wouldn't say that. I say he did it for whatever reason he did. But he was protecting the individual. Whatever reason, he didn't give the full truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Right. So we have another. We have a. You know, you mentioned Eli Benjamin. Eli Benjamin's still living. We met with him most recently 3 months ago, in December of 2009, down in Albuquerque. He was a corporal in the 390th Air Service Squadron. He was a security-type guy, helped guard the silver plates, the B-29 bombers that would, in case of war with Russia, they would take off and drop the atomic bomb. And so he was one of the security personnel assigned to that. Top secret clearance, et cetera, et cetera. And he was a corporal who was told to get over to the big hangar, report to the big hangar, and take his gun with him. And so he goes over there, and this is where all the wreckage was brought, as I mentioned earlier, and the bodies were initially brought. So he goes over there, and there's this lieutenant just beside himself. There's MPs trying to restrain him. He just absolutely lost it. And what had happened was, according to Benjamin, this officer had been out to the crash site earlier that day, saw the wreckage, and when he got back, he was told to report to the big hangar, and he saw the bodies, the little bodies with the big heads, and that was just too much for him. So he absolutely flipped when he saw that, realizing that these were from someplace not on the earth, and so he lost it. He was supposed to lead the detail that took these creatures from the base, the big hangar, over to the base hospital, and he couldn't do it. So out comes the lieutenant colonel, and he points to Eli Benjamin, who had just arrived with his gun. He said, "You, get over here." And that's the way they do it in the military. If you're available, you could be it.
Yeah.
having been there myself.
Right place at the right time. They don't even ask questions. It's, hey, here,
right. That's why anybody who's been in the military, if you're in a lineup and someone says, "I need a volunteer," never let your eyes go on to the person who is asking for volunteers.
Yeah,
that's
you
why
never
everybody
volunteer.
First
you
eye contact volunteer. Volunteers, right?
Yeah, you are volunteer. You never volunteer for anything.
Yes, that. That's why when they say, "I want to volunteer," everybody looks down at their shoes. They don't want their eyes to even give a hint that they're considering it. So, anyway, Benjamin just arrives, and he's looking at this, and this officer says, "You, get over here." And he says, "You're going to lead this. I want these units," that's what they call them, "I want these units taken over to the base hospital as quickly as possible." And so Benjamin... At this point, the gurneys, they have a white sheet over them, so he doesn't know what's on the white sheet. He had heard the rumors about some sort of crash and of a flying saucer, but he didn't know what this was. So up pulls a ambulance, or either an ambulance or a military truck of some sort. The back door opens up, and they start transferring the gurneys to this truck, and the sheet falls off of one, and he sees one of the creatures, and he called it, his term for it was species. To this day, he calls it a species. He said, "I saw the species," and what it was one of these little fellas with the big heads, and he got a real good look at it, and he said, "Oh my God, I don't know what this is," but he was determined to fulfill his mission. So he puts the sheet back over the gurney, and they load up the bodies. There were three of them in this particular set, and so the ambulance, they follow it over to the base hospital. Benjamin goes into the hospital, and he stays with the bodies in the examination room until he's relieved, and he sees, you know, nurses and medical people around the gurneys looking at these things, and one of the medical personnel comes over and says, Corporal, you're relieved, you go back to your unit. So that was the end of his mission, but it stayed with him the rest of his life. According to his wife, he would wake up in the middle of the night with sweating profusely, haunting nightmares and things like that for years and years from this particular episode. Yes.
And again, on that note, we've come up to the top of the hour, so I'm going to have to stop you there for just a second, Tom, as we have to take another break here. It's top of the hour, so...
go to the restroom and rest if you must.
Yes, yes. So, top of the hour, and what are you going to play us out with there,
Reed? My little animals, House of the Rising Sun.
Ooh, appropriate.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll be back in how long?
In 4 minutes, 31.9 seconds.
So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Thomas J. Carey, co-author of Witness to Roswell.
Exactly, and don't touch that mouse button. Be right back. This is Reap So. You're listening to Dread Radio with Ed Kraft and myself. And Thomas Carey is our guest today. How do you like my Ed Kraft voice?
And you are Reap So, by the way. You said myself, so.
And no, don't forget, Ed Kraft and myself, I am Reap.
Yeah, and myself, you are Reap So. But also, let's not forget, by the way, folks, while we're here, we got to plug Pulse Radio, which is our...
Yes, we're on PulseRadioOnline.net. Sorry.
And, of course, tomorrow night, we got great news. We are no longer late night on Saturdays on Jackalope 105, but we have been moved to Thursday night. That's right, tomorrow night, prime time. 6 p.m. Pacific and 9 p.m. Eastern Time, prime time on Jackalope 105 FM. So if you miss it tonight on our regular live time, you can catch us replayed during prime time on Jackalope 105 FM. So be sure and check that out, okay? Yes. We've got to support them. Kudos, Jackalope.
And I want to welcome Lee back from Canada. I hope the flight was good.
Yeah, he goes over to Canada and he doesn't stop here in the
United States. He didn't come visit us, man. He's just like across the border. He didn't come see us.
And we're in Northern California. I mean, how close can you get?
I'm telling you.
Hey, we're out for. I'll tell you what, blood on you, man.
Damn, blimey, Gitch. You can't trust them to come visit you for nothing.
I'll tell you what. But anyway, we're talking about witnesses with our guest tonight, Thomas J. Carey, who's co-author with Donald Schmidt on Witness to Roswell. He's not, you know, this man is incredible. He's got a background. He's got a PhD in all kinds of things, I'll tell you. I've been on Larry King Live, Coast to Coast, and the list goes on. And as we mentioned earlier, Todd, you know, there's about, the government's put out about three official, and this is what's really funny. Usually the government puts out one official explanation for something. They put out like four official explanations on the Roswell, which I find...
Right, and one, and a fifth unofficial. Because there's too many media people now using the term myth, the myth of Roswell. If you remember Peter Jennings, ABC news reporter, Peter Jennings, he died. Yep. Yeah, he died a few years ago. He was Canadian, very distinguished speaking and looking. He did a special, a two-hour special on UFOs the year he died. I think it was 03. And he did a segment just generally on UFOs, which I thought was very, very well done. Seemed to be fair and balanced. But the next segment was on Roswell, and all it was, he said, Roswell is a myth, and we're not going to spend any more time. It's not a real event. It's a myth. And
I'm Peter thinking, Jennings
oh,
said
my
that?
Goodness.
Yeah.
Wow, I like him, too. I did.
Yes, he said the myth of Roswell, but he did nothing to support that conclusion. Nothing to support that conclusion. It was a declaration, a proclamation, as Stan Friedman likes to say, investigation by proclamation, which is exactly what that was. And we've heard a number of other media types using the term myth now.
And well, that's like I watch Stan and Don and he'll get bashed with Larry King, basically, because of I won't say bash, but there's certain Mr. Scientists.
Oh, I was on that show, too.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
Mr. Nye was not exactly...
Was it Bill Nye? Is that the guy's name?
Well,
he wears a bow tie?
Mr. Nye.
I kind of like Bill Nye.
I did until I watched his opinions on the whole subject and how he tried to disprove something... scientific.
Yeah, well, you can't like anyone all the time. I mean, Ed's a good example. I don't like him all the time.
I actually felt sorry for him because he was so unprepared. He had done no investigation, had nothing to say other than show me the evidence. And by evidence, he meant like the steering wheel from one of those flying saucers. That's what he meant. Of course, we don't have that, but he didn't understand that, you know, legal evidence is also evidence. But he wanted scientific evidence. But
when I talked to Stan, he was overwhelmed by. I mean, the last thing Stan had to say was he just went. Yeah, I mean, he was furious about the whole thing.
Well, you know what the problem is that they put these skeptics on, and all they do is waste airtime because they don't do any research. They don't know the subject. They don't know the evidence.
Some skeptics.
They don't know.
Some skeptics.
Well, I'll tell you, speaking of that, we got a caller on the line. Is that okay to take a caller for you there, Tom?
Sure.
All right. I think our
Bill Nye, is it?
Yeah. I seriously doubt it.
Our producer Polly is there, by the way, which we got a kudos.
Welcome back, Polly. Thank you, Polly. We love you.
We couldn't do the show without her. But she's. I think we got a caller on the line there. Let's see if they're still there.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello, Wes. Hello. You're here. We can hear you.
Wes. Okay.
Hey, Ed and Reed. It's good to talk to you guys again. Mr. Carey, it's a pleasure to be able to get to talk to you and get to ask you some questions.
Sure.
I've actually read the first Witness to Roswell book. I haven't been able to get a copy of the revised one. It's always on back order whenever I try to get it. So some of my questions I don't ask you, they may have been already covered in your revised version of it. First of all, I want you to pull out a name for you. Hunter Key.
Hunter Penn?
Yes, Hunter Penn. Is there any way that we can link him to the supposed suicide of the nurse at Roswell during the time of the accident?
Fellas, I couldn't understand that. What was the question? I couldn't understand quite clear enough.
Ask again, Wes.
Okay, Hunter Penn, as we all know, was kind of the muscle for Roswell.
Yeah.
He's the enforcement guy. And then, obviously,
he's the enforcer.
You have this mysterious suicide by the nurse at Roswell that supposedly put a plastic bag over his head, but at the same time, she had bruises and cuts on her wrist. Is there any way that we could link Hunter Penn to this, since it was in his kind of line of work?
Who had bruises and cuts?
The nurse that supposedly committed suicide.
Spell that out in the chat room.
Hunter Penn is...
Okay. Go ahead.
Hunter Penn.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I was asking Wes to spell out in the chat room, Tom. I'm sorry.
He's talking about Hunter Penn. This was a witness that was actually ferreted out by Tony Bregaglia, who lives in Florida, is also working on the case. He's an independent investigator. He's done some amazing work. And he found the daughter of this fellow, Hunter Penn, who was in World War II. Hunter Penn was a pilot for this B-17 known as Hell's. The group was called Hell's Angels, and he was a member of this bomber group. Well, after the war, he got into security, and he found himself at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as a sort of a security strongman. Whenever they needed a dirty job to be done, that was Hunter Pence's bailiwick. They would send him out there to do the dirty work. Well, in the Roswell incident, the initial silencing was done by the members of the 509th Bomb Group, namely a lieutenant by the name of Arthur J. Philbin. He was a former Brooklyn police officer, and he was in security at Roswell, and he was sent around to silence witnesses. They also used the county sheriff, George Wilcox, to do that. But we can speculate that in certain instances where Wilcox refused to do it because he knew he would know the person, they would bring in Arthur Philbin. Well, after the initial round of silencing was finished, they wanted to make sure that the civilians in and around Roswell, in and around Corona, the ranchers out there, that they would remain silent. So they brought in Hunter Penn to reemphasize how important it was for them to remain silent. And according to his daughter, this fellow Hunter Penn was a real... Well, he didn't have a, you know, you've heard the saying, a couple fries short of a happy meal.
Exactly.
He was not playing with a full deck. He was not playing with
a
full deck.
He was short of a picnic, was he?
He was missing a few nuggets in his box.
A few rides short of a carnival.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a couple tools not in his toolbox.
Yeah.
And one of the tools that was in there was an ice pick. According to his daughter, this fellow had a fascination with ice picks. And according to her, she thinks he used one at Roswell. And so they brought him in there to get physical if necessary, but to get the ranchers and the civilians to remain silent by offering up the possibility of the ultimate sanction if they didn't. And that's what he did.
All right. Now, there's another individual, or rather, you know, an interesting part to this. And now, we've promised everybody some new news on Roswell, which I think you and Don have really uncovered. And that's the Braglia Battelle situation.
Yes.
Am I pronouncing it correct? Now, that's something I think nobody's really aware of. How about getting into some of that?
Yeah. This goes along with the physical evidence lead. Don and I, whenever we get a lead either relating to the bodies or to physical evidence, that lead automatically goes to the top of our pile, our lead pile. And that, you know, because those are the things that we're most interested in, is finding physical evidence, the Holy Grail of Roswell, as we call it. And I guess about 2 years ago, I don't know how we hooked up with Tony Braglia. I must have seen something published by him online, and I said, wow, this guy's doing some work here. And, to make a long story short, Tony has been tracking down some work that was done out of, originally, the contract was from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to Battelle Memorial Institute, which is like a think tank, but it does a lot of metallurgical work, right? Wright-Pat is located in Dayton, Ohio, where actually Don Schmidt is today. Battelle Institute is in, is it Cleveland or, yeah, I guess it's Cleveland, yeah. Columbus, I'm sorry,
Columbus, Ohio.
There we go.
So, out of convenience, the Air Force, if they, you know, they had some think tanks type stuff to do or some research to do, they would farm it out to Battelle Institute. Well, Tony now has evidence from scientific articles. These are regularly published, refereed scientific articles, metallurgical in nature, that purport to show a contract was instituted from Wright-Patt Air Force Base in 1948 to Battelle to basically try to research and recreate this memory metal. Now, the memory metal was one type of the wreckage that has been described to every researcher on this case as being recovered from the one, you know, from the crash site, and it was described by a number of witnesses to be metal or metallic looking, light as a feather, but indestructible. You couldn't cut it, burn it, scratch it, tear it, do anything to it, but you could just wad it up in your hand, hold it over a flat surface, say a foot or two over a flat surface, let it go, and it would flatten out before it hit the surface.
Actually, the metal I've seen, you had to apply heat to it, but, yeah.
Well, nitinol, they can, nitinol you have to apply heat to, but you can do the same thing to nitinol. It's an amalgam of nickel and titanium. TI, nitinol, the OL stands for the Ordnance Laboratory, the U.S. Navy Ordnance Lab, who claimed the discovery years later, but it was really this Air Force contract in 1948 and 49.
Which actually makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because the government has a big thing with compartmentalization and outsourcing.
Right. Now, Tony Braglia has tracked down as many of the scientists that have worked on this project as he can, and he's even talked to a few. And when it comes to linking nitinol or the nickel titanium research to Roswell, they all clam up. They swallow the microphone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he's still on that. And what's interesting is that these scientific articles, they all mention a progress report from 1948, they call it the Second Progress Report to the Air Force from Battelle on this research. Well, after initially being rebuffed, he has gotten a copy of that Second Progress Report that even the library at Wright-Patterson couldn't find it, and the library at Battelle couldn't find it. But they send a FOIA request to the Department of Defense, one of the, you know, subunits in the Department of Defense, and they actually got a copy of this. Unfortunately, all the good stuff that Tony would have been interested in was redacted. So he now has a request in for the first progress report. Now, if there was a second, there had to be a first. So he's requested the first progress report, which should give the background of this Air Force contract to Battelle. So that's where he is right now on this. If he can get something that that can link the wreckage to Roswell, excuse me, it would really be it would actually substitute for an actual piece. Now let me tell you, excuse me.
Right.
There's a fellow in California, the place Livermore, because Battelle has a. You know, they got six labs, I think, all over the country, and one of them is in Livermore, the Lawrence Livermore lab. Some fellow who worked on this heard us on another show about a year ago, year and a half ago, and he described being in the lab one day when they brought in this strange metal, and his only instructions were, try to figure out what this is.
Nice.
Try to figure this out. And so he described what it was, and it was the memory metal. It was what we would call the memory metal, the stuff that would retain its shape, shape-shifting, as he called it.
You can actually compress that metal down to nothing so you can transport it, right?
Yes.
And then, yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Gotcha.
And the instructions were, try to figure out what makes this work or makes it do this. And he sent me, he actually kept a piece of this. It's a very tiny piece he keeps in a test tube, and he sent me a scan of that over the internet, and I believe it's a piece of the Roswell wreckage. So in my mind, I have at least have a photograph of a piece. One of the pieces that he worked on in the Lawrence Livermore lab, trying to figure out what that stuff was, and he described the properties of it, and it was the memory metal.
All right. Well, when you speak of the memory metal, I want to go back to where, which I found it interesting. You mentioned the heat and how you had to heat it up to make it go back into place, and I want to go back to where Reap. You mentioned you saw this metal and had to put heat under it. Where did you see it?
I saw this actually on a Discovery Channel program where a guy was talking about where you could build cities, and he showed this spring he took and just mutilated this spring and put a blow dryer on it and went right back to being the original spring. And this guy is talking about how you could actually build cities and you could transport cities with this metal, where you could compress them down to the size where you could put them wherever you wanted and then expand these cities. And the guy was, he was a billionaire, you know, and maybe kind of a kook, but it was very interesting to watch this. And the video was awesome, where you can watch this metal actually retain its shape. And you know what? Metal will do that. I mean, naturally it will do that to one point. But this guy, the spring actually retained, went right back to the original shape. And I know that I've read about it in other sites where actually there is metal that does do that. I mean, so
it makes you
very,
wonder.
It's
the same thing.
It's very
Go
interesting.
Go ahead.
Yeah, what you can do, what they've done is that varying the amounts of nickel and titanium,
yep,
you can change the temperature at which it'll spring back.
That's
so,
right.
You know, they can make it to where, well, it'll, you know, have to be, it'll spring back even in under cold conditions,
yep,
or very hot by alternate or varying the nickel and titanium.
Yep.
So, in his description to me, this gentleman from Lawrence Livermore, there's no doubt in my mind anyway that that he kept a piece of the so-called memory metal. It was silvery, you know, aluminum silvery type color.
And, now, I have a question. I have a question from the chat about General Ramsey and a telegram that he received. And a photograph,
yes.
And a telegram, and
General Ramey, yep,
Ramey,
General,
I'm sorry,
Roger,
yes, Ramey, and whether enhancements have helped to kind of tell a story about that telegram or not.
Yes, he's talking about the famous Ramey memo, as it's known. It's the right now. It's the smoking gun of Roswell. Just like the memory medal is the holy grail of Roswell, the Ramey memo is the smoking gun, and what it is. I mentioned the Ramey press conference that debunked that took away the flying saucer story and substituted the weather balloon. In that press conference, there were several pictures taken of General Ramey kneeling beside this rubber weather balloon and tinfoil radar kite. In his hand, you could see a piece of paper. It's a telex, is what it is. It's a telex. And there were a number of pictures taken of Ramey, and in the last one that was taken, you can see where between the previous shot that was taken of him and the one that's in the last shot, he had tried to quickly read it because it's now folded over.
You're
right?
Talking about the Rudiak memo, aren't you?
Yes, yes. Okay. Rudiak has done the most work on it. And now I can tell you this, though, before I ever heard of David Rudiak, I bought a copy of the Stan Friedman had gone to University of Texas Arlington, where the original photos were kept, and did scans of them, and he put them on a disc, a CD, and was selling them, so for $25. So I bought one, and before I ever heard of David Rudiak, I put it on my CD drive. I had a few MUFON members with me. I used to hold meetings in those days once a month. And within 10 seconds, this is no lie, I was able to read the words and the victims of the wreck that you forwarded to blank blank at Fort Worth, Texas. I read that within 10 seconds. And those half a dozen MUFON members who were here would be my witnesses. It took me only 10 seconds to read that. The victims of the wreck that you forwarded to the something at Fort Worth, Texas. To me,
exactly.
Were very clear.
All right, we've got a caller on the line. I believe it's Jen. Jen, you got...
Jeanette, yes.
You there? Or Jeanette? Are you there?
Did we lose her?
We
might have lost her.
Maybe
there, she'll call back. It's time for a break, you guys.
All right, so, yeah.
Take a break.
Wow, we're flying through this one.
We
so
are flying through
right
this,
back
aren't we?
I just wanted to say the significance of those words, victims of the wreck, takes away the weather balloon story.
Yes,
it takes
does.
Takes away the weather balloon story.
Well, I'm into that one, so we'll talk about that when we come back, because I've written about that myself, and I really want to get into that one. So we'll come back on that topic when we come back in how many seconds?
4 minutes, 35.2 seconds.
Right here on Dread Radio with Reebso, Ed Kraft, and our guest tonight, Thomas J. Carey. All right, we're live here on Dread Radio. I'm Ed Kraft, along with my co-host, Reap So, and our guest tonight, Thomas J. Carey, co-author of Witness to Roswell. And man, some of the information we're getting tonight is new information. I mean, we're talking about everything from, what is it, Nittenall to some of the witnesses. We're really getting some new information here, folks. So if you're tuning in live tonight, we're on Pulse Radio Network, one of our great
PulseRadioOnline.net. I'm going to send you a little memo so you can get it right.
Yeah, .net. I got to put the .net in there.
PulseRadioOnline.net and Jack 105 FM on Thursdays. So.
Yeah, Thursdays at, what is it now? We're on prime time, so we have to put that there. Yep. We're on prime time on Thursdays, you know, 6 p.m. Pacific time.
On FM, too. Who would have thought it?
Yeah, we're really kicking some butt there. You guys are amazing. All our listeners out there, we got to thank you. And, of course, check out Witness to Roswell. And before we go further, Tom, give them a website or how they can get in touch with you and the book and all that stuff.
Oh, sure. Witness to Roswell can be Witness to Roswell can be obtained at your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Borders, are the two main ones, or Amazon. You can also obtain it on our website, www.roswellinvestigator.com. That's www.roswellinvestigator.com. Just click on the book, and it'll connect you to Amazon. So those are the main ways, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Amazon.
And there's a lot of great information on the website, so I encourage you to go there.
I encourage everybody
to go through the website because, and not the other thing. I'm going to tell you, go through the website, not the companies, because the authors actually make money off of the websites, not the publishers and these stores. So go to the websites, not the stores. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Where were we?
Giving out your information.
Yeah. So those are the main items. In the book, it also has the contact numbers in the back for Don and myself. You can get my phone number from the book. I won't give it over the air because you never know who's calling.
Yeah, exactly right.
So those are the main ways. As I said, our book was number one in the world in 2007, 2008, and the revised edition has everything that the first book has, but additional chapters and additional follow-up on the other chapters. And I have to say, not to pat myself on the back or Don on the back, but these are the facts, is that the consensus is that these two books are the best books ever written on Roswell. That's not me saying it. That's many, 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 many people.
And I'll back that up.
Yep.
I'll back that up myself.
So let's get to our caller. I think she's still on the line.
Are you there, caller?
Jeanette, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. To play devil's advocate for a moment, I'm curious. I mean, it's been a fascinating interview. I'm wondering what your guest thinks about so many of the previous authors, so-called experts on the Roswell crash, have recounted their accounts, their so-called eyewitness, military, and non-accounts. And what does he think of that? Because many have.
I'm sorry. They have done what? The previous authors have done what?
They have recounted their stories. They have.
Are you saying
basically recanted? Yes.
Oh. There haven't been that many.
Some of the biggest names in the Roswell controversy have.
I mean, actually, there's considering the number of witnesses, there's very few. There's the, and the thing is that we've, it's not that we bought them hook, line, and sinker, and someone else uncovered them. Whenever there was a witness that we had questions about, we went right after the questions, and there was a fellow, Gerald Anderson was a fellow we had big questions about his veracity, and we believe we exposed him as a hoaxer. That's one. Frank Kaufman was another. This fellow was from Brooklyn, and he claimed to have been on this inside group that took control of the recovery of the craft. And I have to tell you, from the very first I ever met Frank Kaufman, I felt there was something wrong. And over the years, we finally got Mr. Kaufman to admit that many of the things he told us were not true, and especially the so-called impact crash site. This would be the last crash site where the remains of the ship and some of the bodies were found. He finally admitted that was a bogus site. He just made it up. Well, we already knew that. We just had to get him to admit it. He admitted it on his deathbed. And, we don't use him in our account either. You won't find Frank Kaufman's account
our
book.
No, I wouldn't. But
sorry?
I'm just saying, is it frustrating that some, were even revealed as pathological liars?
No, there aren't that. The thing is, we've interviewed the... I would say that I've interviewed 2,000 people so far on this case. Not everyone's a witness.
Exactly. So some aren't going to be credible either. I mean, that's normal.
No, absolutely
yes.
Not. Devil's advocate type question.
I think it's a fair question, and I think Thomas has addressed it. When you interview 2,000 plus people, some of the people are going to be effing liars. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, some people are going to be.
Oh, absolutely.
Wants to get their thumb in the pie, if you will.
But he's ruled those people out.
Exactly. And still,
there's
what?
People, the majority of earlier Roswell researchers and writers, you know, supposed witnesses, have been outed. They have, you know, been proven as liars, frauds, pathological liars.
Okay, so he's interviewed over 2,000 people, and the majority haven't been.
I would like to know who you're talking about. I've mentioned Gerald Anderson and Frank Coffin. There's two. I'd have to think hard for another one.
Kevin Randall, Donald Schmidt, Glenn Dennis.
They're not with.
Schmidt has not been outed.
Okay, Jeanette. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
I don't know. I don't know where she's going with that.
All right, yeah, I don't either.
I don't
Thank
either.
You, Jeanette.
Any of us do. Thanks a lot, Jeanette.
I mean, Kevin Randall and Don. I don't understand.
Didn't we have Don Schmidt on this show?
Yeah. I think that's exactly what we're talking about. I think Don Schmidt has revealed the same information. You know, I don't really understand where that was going.
I don't even
They're not witnesses. They're authors. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
Don Schmidt wasn't recanting anything when he was on the show.
He was just, I think it was in support of the same information we're talking about. I really don't get what
you know, I think you were, you know, she was a debunker, and they say things amongst themselves and they believe it.
Well,
and
she talked about being devil's advocate, so we'll give her that and just roll
yeah,
on.
Yeah, we'll get that one and write it off the books. Let's get back to the subject at hand before we left and change the topic. You were talking about the David Rudiak scenario there, Tom.
And, oh, yes.
You know, I've seen the actual document, you know, that was in the Ramey memo, and I've seen the version that the government says cannot be read. And once it's blown up, I can clearly see what David Rudiak has put down, and that is, and the victims of the wreck in the disc, they will ship. And, you know,
yep.
I'm sorry, but when I see victims and disc in the same thing, plus I see wreck, and I can clearly read these in the blow-up that the government says is not readable. Once you blow it up, you can still see the words. David did not have to blow it up or recreate it. You can still see it. And the government says it's not readable.
And you know the provenance of this memo. It's not something that some UFO investigator cooked up and tried to foist in the public. It's from a photograph taken by J. Bond Johnson of a Fort Worth Star-Telegram on July the 8th, 1947. So there's no question about where this photo came from. You blow it up, and there it is. And
it was published in a newspaper.
Yes.
That photograph is national.
And it's not talking about their water condenser has gone out, they don't have any water. It's not talking about supplies. It's not talking about groceries. It's not talking about Ramey's furniture. It's talking about, it's got the word disc, you can see it, and it talks about victims. So that takes away a weather balloon. And at the very end, the last sentence, it talks about staging weather balloon demonstrations for the public, which they absolutely did the following day. They staged weather balloon demonstrations to say, folks, here's what you're seeing. These are what you're seeing as flying saucers. And this is what the Roswell thing was.
That's what I have a question about that, too, is, let me see. They're wondering why the government would say they were launching weather balloons when they weren't launching weather balloons from that Air Force Base.
Repeat that one again.
Sorry. Someone's asking me in the chat about why would they use weather balloons when they weren't even launching weather balloons out of the Air Force Base in Houston?
Well, they would launch weather balloons for every time, at Roswell, they would have, tests of atomic bomb drops. You know, they didn't, use real atomic bombs, but they would use decoys or something in place of an atomic bomb to do their bomb runs on their test range. Well, they would launch these targets to get the, the weather directions and the wind directions and things like that. They also did that out of Alamogordo, White Sands, where they were testing the captured German rockets. So they were, and they would launch a balloon, weather balloon, every day from the tallest building in Roswell every day to get the weather trajectories. So I'm not sure what the question is, but they were launching balloons.
This is the question, so I just thought I would pass it along. Sorry.
Well, actually, that makes a lot of sense, because I've seen the room, and here's an interesting thing. I've actually seen, Tom, and I have to agree with you on that, I've seen the weather balloons they used at that time, and they're enormous. Some of them.
Well, if you're talking about the Skyhooks, they didn't use the Skyhooks at that point.
Okay.
The Skyhooks are these large polyethylene balloons that that they say Captain Thomas Mantell was chasing in 1948 when he lost the consciousness and his P-51 crashed. Those are those big, huge, they look like white discs from underneath, you know?
Well,
and they're very high.
Even the Project Mogul itself, if you put all the components of the Project Mogul balloons into General Ramey's office, it still wouldn't fit.
Right. The story was that it was a single weather balloon. This is 1947, that it was a single weather balloon. It wasn't until the 90s where Carl Flock came up with this Project Mogul, which was a top secret project at the time, but the constituents, elements of it, the rubber weather balloons, tinfoil radar targets, they were all prosaic, commonplace items that were not top secret. The project's top secret, the things used in it were not top secret. So it wasn't until the 90s that they came up with this Project Mogul, which had up to 26 rubber weather balloons attached in a long, like a tail of a kite, you know, dangling down. There were like 26 rubber weather balloons and up to six or seven tinfoil radar targets. It was a huge thing, 900 feet in length, okay, but they were just rubber weather balloons and radar targets, nothing that would shock anybody, to stupefy the people down at the Roswell Army Airfield. Your six-year-old would be able to identify them. So they wouldn't be able to identify the project, what it was for, but they would identify the balloons in tinfoil. So it was then that they came up with this Mogul. And in 47, there was no hint that weather balloon on Roger Ramey's floor was just one of many that were recovered in this crash. What you saw there was what they were claiming was recovered, just that one. So that story just falls apart. Plus, the descriptions of the eyewitnesses do not track with a weather balloon. And you want to talk about recanting, the Air Force's star witness, Bessie Brazel Schreiber, who was Mac Brazel's daughter. She was 14 years old at the time, and she seemed to be saying that she went out with her father that day and they found this rubberized metal or metallic rubber, take your pick, and it had these strange flowery designs on some of the balsa wood type struts, what have you. Well, they used her for this Mogul thing. Well, we stayed in touch with her, and we interviewed her in person. We were the last ones to actually interview her in person, and she recanted that story. She said that was another event that had nothing to do with Roswell. She did not go out there and see what was recovered. She may have been at the ranch house, but she never went out to the crash site. The ranch house was 10 miles from the crash site, so she didn't go out there. She recanted. That lady wants to talk about recanting. The Air Force's star witness recanted. There was no one, I repeat, no one, living or dead, who is or was a credible witness to a balloon event in Mac Brazel's sheep pasture. Just, there isn't any. There aren't any.
Yeah, there aren't. And, you know, I want to retouch on something here, Tom. And this goes back to the weather balloon issue. I want to clarify, because there's still some issue there with regard to the weather balloons. They were launched from that area. Yes, they did launch weather balloons, because this was an atomic, you know, this airbase was the home of the, you know, this was our atomic bombing base.
Strike force.
Yeah. If there was a bomb going to be dropped, it was going to be dropped from Roswell. You know, the bomb was going to be coming from Roswell Air Force Base. You know?
Exactly.
So they had air balloons, you know, weather balloons going up all the time to determine, you know, what the weather was going to be and where it was coming from. I mean, this was our most strategic air base in the U.S.
I mean, we had to know
everything about the weather and air currents and everything else, because we had to know where the radiation was going to go and et cetera.
Exactly. And we have a witness, Earl Fulford. He's featured in our book, who told us that they were sending weather balloons up all the time. It was just a procedure that they did several times a day. Because, like you say, the 509th Bomb Group was our atomic strike force. It was the only atomic strike force in the world for any country, as we had a monopoly at that time on the atomic bomb. It would be another 2 years before the Soviet Union detonated their first one. So, it was just standard protocol.
All right, and on that note, we've got about 5 minutes left, Tom, before we have to wrap it up here. Any final thoughts or comments or anything you want to get out there?
Yes, I'll give you a new item here. Speaking of physical evidence, we have come in contact with someone whose father was at Roswell in 1947, and he was a photographer. And we actually first got in contact with this person over 10 years ago, and he was still alive, and we never could seem to hook up to find out what he had pictures of. Well, we've gotten a few scans that they sent Don, and Don sent to me, and of what appears to be, we know it's the site because we can see the Capitan Mountains in the background. That's sort of our, we know it's the right one if we can see the Capitans in a certain juxtaposition. But on the ground, there are what appears to be pieces of, well, aluminum-type pieces strewn all over the ground. It's a bad photo we have, as it was taken with a 35 millimeter of a picture that was taken in 1947, and so it's not the clearest picture, but it certainly looks very, very much like what we would expect the periphery of this crash site would have looked like. So, Don, whenever we get out I hope I didn't tell you what state it's in. Whenever we get out there,
we'll figure that out later.
we're going to make a beeline there to see these photos firsthand.
All right,
and,
great.
Speaking of the Ramey memo, we're working on a documentary, and we have a fellow who's in the photography business who thinks he can really clean that Ramey memo up even better than what you see under photographic software.
Can't wait for that one. But we've got to wrap it up, Thomas. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I got to get John back with you.
But I have a lot more. I have a lot more.
We'll get you back on. We'll get you back on.
Come on anytime. I know Don wants to come back. I can get Don on anytime. Hopefully you'll come back with him. We wanted to get you both on at the same time tonight. It's been like pulling teeth to get you both on. I've been begging Don for the last couple of years to get you both on, but thankfully
it's tough being popular, isn't it, Thomas?
He never told me.
Oh, you know him. He's got the ego of a, you know, I'm only kidding. But
right.
We'll get you both on, and hopefully you'll come back. And maybe I can get him back on next week. Actually, I'd like to get you back on for my birthday, if I can con him out of it, if he's
happy
not still shooting next week. Hopefully, I can get you both on next week for my birthday.
Well, we're actually both retired, so we don't have any excuses. Chip Don has
exactly.
one today. But
well, actually, he makes more excuses than, you know, he likes to play. I know him too well. But anyway, we got to wrap it up here because we don't want to run out of time, so everybody can hear it tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Jackalope 105 FM. And any other comments there? Don't forget Reepso Radio, guys.
Don't forget.
Witness to Roswell, the great book.
Yeah. Yeah, don't forget that. And what's the website there, Reap?
ReapSoRadio.com. ReapSoRadio.com. Every Tuesday and Friday. Yep.
And again, Tom?
www.roswellinvestigator.com.
And you have been listening to us on PulseRadioOnline.net. I want to thank Knocker Lee, and I'm glad he made the plane flight. We got to roll, you guys.
All right. Here on Dread Radio. Yep. Thanks a lot.
Talk to you later. See you next Wednesday, Ed.
All right. Take care, guys. Right,
thank you, Thomas. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Good night.
I feel like there is no need for conversation. Some questions I better left unreasoned. I would rather reveal myself than my situation. Now and then I consider hesitation. The more the night shines through me, I pretend to close my eyes. The more the dark consumes me, I pretend I'm happy. But it I did were just to be different, to spare myself all the constant shame of my existence. I would surely redeem myself in my desperation. Hearing now express my situation. Conversation.